Have you ever wondered, like, if you can be raped, if you're just too afraid to fight back? It's a tough question to even think about, but that's what we're diving into today. It's a case called People v. Iniguez. It's a landmark case, and it really reshaped how we understand consent and how fear plays into these sexual assault cases. And we're specifically going to be looking at California because that's where this case took place.
Okay,
And
great.
we're going to really unpack how the California Supreme Court kind of made this groundbreaking decision and clarified how fear can just completely override consent.
Yeah, it's a case that when you really look at it, it forces you to confront some really uncomfortable truths about sexual assault.
Absolutely. So to kind of set the scene a little bit, we're talking about Mercy, the victim in this case, and Iniguez, who was an acquaintance, and he assaulted her the night before her wedding. And she completely froze in fear and didn't resist at all. And the crazy thing about this case is that he was actually convicted, but then an appeals court overturned the conviction, saying there wasn't enough evidence of force.
Yeah, that's kind of what propelled this case to the Supreme Court. And they had to grapple with, whether or not his actions met the legal definition of rape, even though there wasn't that traditional physical force that you see in a lot of cases.
So there's that kind of question of like, what is force? Does it have to be physical or can it be something else? Okay, so let's actually break down what happened. So Mercy was asleep at a friend's house, and Iniguez, who was much larger than her, came into the room, removed her clothes, and assaulted her. She was just completely frozen in fear the whole time.
And you know that detail about him being so much larger than her is really important. Like 100 pounds heavier, it speaks to the power dynamic, It speaks to the inherent threat that his size and the suddenness of the attack presented. And the fact that she was asleep, vulnerable in a place where she should have felt safe. It's just terrifying to think about.
Yeah, incredibly scary. So with that all being said, how did the court ultimately interpret the law? Like what?
Well, they focused on the California rape statute,
Okay.
which at the time defined rape as sexual intercourse accomplished against a person's will by force, violence, or fear of immediate bodily injury.
Okay.
And that or is key here because that means that force doesn't have to be physical. It means that the threat, the fear itself, can be the force.
So the law acknowledges that you might not actually fight back if you're afraid for your safety.
And the court actually developed this two-part test to assess this fear. The first part is the subjective fear component. And this asks, did the victim genuinely feel fear of immediate and unlawful bodily injury? And in Mercy's case, her testimony was very clear. She said, "I was afraid, so I just laid there."
Yeah, I mean, that seems pretty straightforward.
It does, but it's also important to note her actions right after the assault. She immediately called a friend, hid outside until the friend arrived. She was clearly terrified of him finding her. All of these actions really corroborated her testimony about her fear.
So her actions backed up what she was saying.
Exactly.
Gotcha. That makes sense. You said there's a two-part test, so what's the second part?
Right. The second part is the objective reasonableness of the fear. This asks, would a reasonable person in the victim's situation have felt the same fear? And this part is where the court really considers the context, the totality of the circumstances.
So it's not just about what she felt, but whether or not her fear was justified given what was happening.
And in this case, the court found that yes, her fear was objectively reasonable. They considered the size difference between her and the perpetrator, the fact that she was asleep when he initiated the assault, the violation of what should have been a safe space, her friend's house, and the fact that she barely knew this guy. All of these factors contributed to a very real and reasonable fear.
This is all really insightful, but I'm wondering, like, what if someone's fear isn't considered objectively reasonable? Maybe because of past trauma or something. Does that mean the perpetrator is off the hook?
That's where it gets really interesting. The court actually addressed that very nuance. They said that even if a victim's fear might be deemed unreasonable by an objective standard, the perpetrator can still be liable if they knowingly exploit that fear to get sex.
Okay, so even if someone's fear comes from something that happened in the past, if the perpetrator recognizes that.
Recognizes and takes advantage of
it. And takes advantage of it, it's still rape.
Exactly. That's the real groundbreaking part of this case. It broadens the scope of the law by recognizing that trauma can have such a profound impact on a person's reactions and that perpetrators shouldn't be able to use someone's past trauma to get away with assault.
Right.
It really acknowledges that fear, even unreasonable fear, can be a powerful tool of coercion.
So this case also kind of debunked this idea that a victim has to physically fight back or even verbally protest.
Exactly.
Just freezing in fear can be enough to demonstrate a lack of consent.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The court rejected this idea that victims have to say no or physically resist.
Yeah.
They acknowledge that fear can be paralyzing.
Right.
And a victim's inability to resist does not equal consent.
Yeah, that's huge.
It's a really critical shift away from those harmful, outdated notions about how a real victim should behave.
Yeah, this really reframes the whole conversation.
Yeah.
I'm starting to see why this case is considered so groundbreaking.
Absolutely.
What did the Supreme Court actually say about this?
Well, there's one line from their decision that I think really captures the essence of this case.
Okay.
They said, any man or woman awakening to find himself or herself in this situation could reasonably react with fear.
It's chilling.
Yeah.
You could really feel the terror that someone in her position must have been going through.
Yeah, and that's where the true impact of this case lies. It shifted the focus from what the victim did or didn't do during the assault to what the perpetrator did to instill that fear.
Right, okay.
It marked a huge step toward a more victim-centered approach to these cases.
So People v. Iniguez really changed how we think about consent and fear in these legal situations.
It really did.
We've covered a lot of ground already, but there's still so much to unpack.
Yeah, we've only just scratched the surface of how this case has really shaped our understanding of these really complex issues. Mm-hmm. One of the most significant things about this case, I think, is how it kind of pushed the courts to move away from those really rigid standards. You know, those really outdated standards for evaluating sexual assault cases.
Okay.
Like, instead of fixating on, you know, did the victim physically resist? It said, okay, let's look at the whole picture.
Right. So, like, you know, taking into account the power dynamic.
Oh, exactly.
The setting, the victim's experience, you know, of fear. Like, it's
the whole, the totality of the circumstances.
Right. It's not just checking off these bullet points.
Yeah.
But really, like, getting into the nitty gritty of what.
Exactly. It recognizes that sexual assault isn't always black and white.
Right.
You know, there's a spectrum of coercion and fear. And I think this case really helped the legal system begin to grasp that complexity.
So, like, imagine you're on a jury for a case like this.
Right.
Would you only consider, did they physically resist?
Mm.
Or would you also factor in, like, wow, they were terrified.
Exactly.
You know, this person was way bigger than them. They were asleep when it started, you know.
You have to consider all of it.
Yeah. People v. Iniguez really forces us to think differently.
It does. Yeah. It challenges us to move beyond those simplistic checklists.
Right.
And really grapple with how complicated these situations are.
It seems like this case reflects like a bigger shift in how we as a society understand consent.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's part of a larger movement, I think, toward more victim-centered laws and a deeper understanding of, you know, the psychology of trauma. I mean, this case really paved the way for the conversations that we're having today about affirmative consent,
right,
coercion, the importance of believing survivors.
It's amazing to think that this one case from 1994
right,
had such a ripple effect on our legal system, but also how we just understand this stuff.
On our culture. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What would you say is like the biggest takeaway for anyone listening, whether they're, you know, future lawyers or judges or just people who, you know, are interested in this topic?
I think the biggest takeaway is that a rape conviction can be based on fear alone.
Okay.
Even without physical force or resistance from the victim.
Okay.
This case fundamentally shifted the focus from what the victim did or didn't do during the assault to what the perpetrator did to instill that fear.
Right.
It's a really powerful statement about consent and how power and coercion can operate.
So moving forward, what are some key things to keep in mind when we analyze these sexual assault cases through the lens of Iniguez? What has this case taught us?
Well, first and foremost, we have to remember that freezing is a normal, even common trauma response.
Right.
It does not equal consent.
Right.
We can't fall into that trap of thinking, well, why didn't they just fight back.
Right.
Trauma manifests in many different ways.
Girl.
And freezing is a very real and understandable reaction.
That's such a good point. And I think so many people just don't get that.
Don't get it.
What else should we be thinking about?
I think we also need to be very mindful of the power dynamics at play.
Okay.
Things like age, size, social status, the relationship between the individuals, all of these can influence the presence and perception of fear.
Right.
And of course, context is key.
Right.
We have to look at the whole picture, yeah. Just like the court did in Iniguez.
And I think lastly, and this kind of goes without saying, but we have to listen to survivors.
Yes.
Their experiences and expressions of fear are valid.
Absolutely.
Regardless of whether they fit into some idea of, you know, how a victim should behave.
Without question, believing survivors and taking their experiences seriously is paramount.
It sounds like Anise have really set the stage for a more nuanced and empathetic approach to understanding these cases.
It represented a huge step forward in the evolution of our legal system and our societal understanding of consent, coercion, and the impact of trauma.
Right.
And, you know, while there's still much work to be done,
yeah.
Iniguez was a critical turning point in the right direction.
Well, this has been a really insightful deep dive so far.
Yeah.
It's really interesting how one case can have such a big impact.
I know, it's amazing.
Not just on the law, but on our culture.
Absolutely.
But before we wrap things up, I want to leave our listeners with like one final thought-provoking question to ponder.
I'm intrigued.
It kind of builds on what we've been talking about, but takes it a step further.
Okay.
So we've talked about how people via Iniguez changed legal definitions.
Right.
But its effects reach far beyond the courtroom.
Mm.
Think about how this case challenges like our own personal assumptions about consent.
Right.
How can you as an individual use this knowledge to create a safer and more just world around you?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
And an important one.
Yeah. How can we be advocates for change?
That's an incredibly important question and one that I think deserves careful consideration.
Yes.
It challenges each of us to reflect on our own role in shaping a culture that respects and upholds true consent.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
It makes you think about, you know, how much work we still have to do.
It does, but you know, cases like this give me hope.
Yeah.
They show that progress is possible, that the law can evolve to reflect, you know, a deeper understanding of these issues of consent and coercion and the lasting effects of trauma.
I agree. It's a powerful reminder that legal precedent isn't just this like static thing.
Right.
It can change as our understanding of, you know, human behavior and societal norms changes.
Exactly. And Iniguez, with its emphasis on fear and the perpetrator's actions, was a major catalyst for that evolution in thinking.
Yeah, hopefully this evolution will continue to lead us toward a justice system that is, you know, more trauma-informed, more equitable, and just more effective at protecting the vulnerable.
I think it will. And I think cases like this really laid the foundation.
Yeah, this deep dive into People v. Iniguez has been so enlightening.
It has been.
It's amazing how, you know, one case can have such a lasting impact, not just on the law, but on our culture, too.
It's true. And as we've discussed, it's a powerful reminder that we all have a role to play in challenging those outdated assumptions and advocating for a world where consent is understood, respected, and upheld.
So to our listeners, we encourage you to continue, you know, exploring this case and what it means and just the broader conversation around consent and coercion and justice.
It's a conversation we all need to be a part of.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.